recording.
Such
Agneta Faw is Frank's guest tonight.
Oh my God,
tonight.
I should have looked through. I just should have looked through that. And I just
put I am L A lazy. So you're going to let her fill the time shuffling through her papers and then
good. Yeah, you yeah, that's good. Be more lazy. Be even more lazy so I can really find everything that I should have done this before, shouldn't I? I can write, I can read anything from this. It wasn't
that
the one I was thinking of.
Is the A P A that is a part of the P E R performance. Shuffling
all right
through the papers is part of the performance.
Thank you. I'm a very good shuffler. I'm going to start with All I Hear. Okay.
Yeah.
I read just like this.
Yes.
It came to me in a dream. A tiny hand got hold of mine and wouldn't let go. A hand without hate at the core of being human. Poor man, beggar man, brother of sleep, son of night, a cold wind turning him out, turns my heart inside out, trying to understand. But all I hear is a child weeping against the wind. This poem, as a poem that is important to me because I wrote it at the beginning of the latest, you couldn't call it conflict because it's a war, in Palestine and Israel. And I wrote it when I was in France, so the first imagery is from France, and it's called Oh Hate. It's all in the poem. To be in the moment, a grey slab of a sky over Italian poplars along the River Rhone, and thinking about the Palestinian boy shot to death, the Israeli soldiers torn to shreds, who tears make tears, who wins loses, who loses wins willfully without thought, who lays his body down to die with the name of God on his lips. Here, silk is made soft, the flowing length of it, enough to make a mummy out of yourself. But in among these thoughts, the smell of a blood-stained rag gets stuffed down the throat of a pitiless bull choking on its own blood. The long tongue of autumn calls to a silence. Overhead, a blackbird stabs its wings deep in the heart. Who do you love most with your eyes closed? Who do you trust most with your eyes closed? These thoughts kill me also, and here comes Mother Death again, flashing her teeth. Oh, hate! How I hate you! But you're so easy to love, so loyal in your blindness. Hold me in your thorny arms and spike me till it hurts so hard I want to let go of you forever and stop boys throwing stones older than themselves at men who should know better than shoot at people smaller and younger than themselves. Stop them becoming fodder for the big boys who play monopoly with people's lives in marbled halls, whose faces they'll never see, whose hands they'll never shake. The moment of truth then, the one you live for, the one you die for. That's a bit. Do you want me to read more on this?
You. L. You. L. I. You live. H. A. Half. Half the year. In Europe, in England?
Yeah, I mean, not strictly half a year in England. It's been approximately 6 months in Italy, France, and England, and then 7 months here, 5 months there, or whatever. So, and then last year also in Croatia. We went through Croatia to Sarajevo, and yeah, and so all those countries, but actually mainly in Italy, most of the time in Italy, and England. This year, not quite sure when the European trip will happen, but it usually happens that way, and then, you know, we both, Jack and myself, we go on this reading tour, and we paint, and it's good. It's good, varied life. I have to speak all these languages.
Is, yes. M. O. Most. People. Would. K. Kill to have that life.
Yeah, but yeah, everyone says, yeah, you're right. Everyone says, oh, you're so lucky. And yes, but at the same time, it's really tiring because if you're constantly on the move, you're always living out of a suitcase, and you become a really kind. I don't mind being ruthless in one way, but it's, you know, especially. I mean, also painter, and I have to carry all this stuff, and we have to carry so much, and then people give us books, and then we accumulate more, so we are forever exhausted. But yes, of course, it's lovely. I don't know. I mean, I think it's lovely, but I think it's also lovely to live in one place.
I.
You would kill for them.
E. T. I bet. We. R H E A heavy heavier oh heavier travelers he bets that we
I
are
bet you
are
I bet well, if you want to bet yeah. Actually I have to say I got better. I used to be terrible. I'm not so bad now because you learn when you travel that this is not good when you, but you still have to carry things. I don't know. I'm trying to be good.
Do you have like a place anywhere where you keep stuff?
Yeah, in the I got stuff in 6, 7, 8 places in the world.
Wow.
Books, paintings, old clothes, document, whatever, all over the place. We've got a base in England. There is a base in England, so there is a kind of. But even in that base, it's a long story. But yeah, my stuff is all over the place, including myself. My is that falling off or not doing the trick?
It's
how?
It's good. It's rustling. I just want to put it in a better spot.
Yeah.
Is it because I'm waving around? So better. Okay.
How? Did you L you luck out to have that life?
I'll give you the short version. Otherwise, it'll be here for a couple of hours.
But, no, You want the long version?
You want the long version? You want
we have 2 hours.
All right, okay. It's very romantic. R-H-E-U-M-A-N-T-I-C. No, basically, I was living in England, though I was born in Sweden, but I moved there in my early 20s. And I lived with some. My partner was an American poet, publisher, called Asa Benvenisti. A very, very interesting man. And we had a very good life. And I lived in London. Then we moved to this other place in England called Hebden Bridge in West Yorkshire, which is a very artistic community, in a bit like San Francisco, but on a very small scale. It's an interesting place because it has the largest gay population in the whole of England. It's only 15,000 people. But it's and lots of artists and poets and strange people like oneself, you know, odds and sods. So there I was living with Asa, and I knew Asa was Jack's oldest friend, Jack Hirschman's oldest friend in the world, from New York. They grew up together. And actually Asa showed Jack the way in poetry, if you like. And so, to cut this long story short. And I met Jack years back in London, and we all corresponded, and, you know, like we do, exchange books. And then Asa died, unfortunately, from diabetes. I mean, you know, side effects. And I was, of course, absolutely felt grief-stricken, finished. And I came to America, and I looked up his friends, you know, and I gave them a little momentum. And then off I went to Central America, and I traveled for 3 months, and it was great. Went back to England, and then I invited Jack, because I worked for this organization arranging poetry festivals, and I invited Jack to read, but it's a friend, and thought nothing of it. I didn't want any more man in my life. That was it. Enough is enough. But there he was, and he was, you know, it wasn't love at first sight, because we had known each other for years.
They all say that. Don't want another man in my life. They all say that.
But there he was. And he put his hand on my shoulder. Too long. And the rest is history. And then, anyway, so we started kind of this back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I was teaching as well. I was teaching poetry and other things, drama, whatever. And I'd lived in this huge house, beautiful old pub. I loved it. It was like a little, you know, castle. And where I used to actually teach from it as well. And anyway, so then I moved to San Francisco as an experiment after a few years. And that was that. And then both of us had connections in Italy. So we were in a very lucky position, you know, two poets, two artists, going to the same kind of places. And that was it. We both were like little, off we went. And we've never looked back. And the same for him, because, you know, this back and forth, and people say, oh my God, you're traveling all the time. But it just became like, it just happened. And then we're getting asked back every year, what can you do? So I said, thank you very much, invite us again. But that was the short version. I can tell you a little bit later. It was very romantic. And we're very blessed. You know, two older people finding each other. And also it was very nice because, you know, when somebody dies who you're very close to, it's very hard to go to another one if you can't take this person with you. But I could, because he was a very old friend of Jack's. Jack wrote a beautiful poem for Asa when Asa died. So there was that connection there already. It was very beautiful. And we're both poets. And
he, in a way, It was J U just A C O continuation.
You want me to continue?
No, he was saying in a
this
way.
Was, oh,
it was just absolutely. It was a,
yeah, but different. Yeah. Because it was different. Because people are different. In fact, very, very different. But I, yeah, you could say it was a continue. But it's a long break. It was many 5 years. But if, you're right. But I thought about that a lot. But it actually is the different people. They are, and it's. But I always think the problem is that if you love somebody very much, and they die, and then you, if you can never speak about them again, it would be very difficult. But there is not that problem.
A. So. T. R. I. A. Triad.
Yeah. Triad. Yeah, in a way, I suppose. Yeah. But the lovely one. That's actually, death figured a lot in my life, and then that's when I did this book called The Long Pale Corridor, because I went through a period when my father, my mother, no, Asa, my father, my mother died in succession, and then five of my friends. So I thought, what is this? What's happening? Everyone was dying. So I had to come to terms with that. And that's when I found that, you know, everything has a meaning. There's a meaning in something. And you don't go necessarily into the negative. It can be a very positive beginning. And you should speak about the death. Like, you know, somebody goes away for years, you speak about them, why can't you speak about the dead? Because you miss them, or they're with you, or whatever.
D. E. Death is A. S. T. A. A stage of life.
Yeah. Really. It is a stage of life, like, you know, like you're born. It's a celebration of someone's life. I'll read you the poem I call Grief, actually. I don't feel sad about it anymore in that way. I mean, of course you feel sad if someone dies, of course you do, but there is all that. Is that your cat? Your little cat? I think it's here. It's called Grief. It's always by the sea, the waves, the storm, bidding the salty water to flood the long, pale corridor on nothingness. That's how I much felt after... you know, after all these people died.
I. H. A. I had. A. A student. Carlos, who, during the course of him working with Frank, he found out he had AIDS.
Yeah.
And so Frank told him that his job, he was a very lusty, lusty guy.
Yeah.
Frank said, your job is to die as lustfully as you live. And he was doing real good until he got real sick.
Yeah.
I. F. C. R. E. Created. A role for him in the performances. He played the dying man.
Oh, really?
And he would be, he was nude and body painted with a sign that said, I have AIDS.
Yeah.
And when people were first led into the performance, they went into this small little tent that we constructed with Carlos. And Carlos would talk to them briefly about death. And he would say that death is not painful in itself. It's nothing to be feared, that it's just a transition. And then people would be led out to the performance. Yeah. P, people. T, H, thought. He was just acting, playing a role.
Yeah.
And when they would find out afterward that he really was the dying man.
Yeah.
But the L, A. Oh, we had, when we did it in Los Angeles, the LA Times sent a reviewer, and he was very impressed with the whole performance. He thought it was wonderful, and then he wanted to interview Frank. So he came to our hotel like a day or two later, and we're talking, and somewhere along the way, Frank mentioned that Carlos really did have AIDS. And the guy was just like, oh, my God, this just went to another place for me.
Right.
He said, I liked it already. But, and so Carlos, when he got really sick, he wouldn't get out of bed. He wouldn't eat. And the people that were taking care of him called Frank and said, we're concerned about Carlos.
Yeah.
Hitman.
You're a hitman.
He called the hitman. So Frank has me drive him over, and we wheel into the room where Carlos is doing his what is that
Camille.
Movie? He's doing his Camille.
Yeah,
you know, the dying person, very dramatic. And Frank said to him, well, you need to look and see if you're really dying. He said, I'll give you till tomorrow.
Right. Oh, my God. I give you till
He said, if you're really dying, and then we're going to help you die.
Yeah.
But if you're not dying, and then you've got to start living, you've got to have fun, you got to get involved
That's
in life.
That's wonderful.
We had a tour coming up that he was scheduled to go on. You have to be in shape to be able to take the train and So, and then we get a call the next day from the people that were taking care of him, and they said, well, I don't know what you said, but not only is he eating, but he insisted on sitting at the table, and he would still have his moments, though, because Frank would go over there to have his weekly sessions, and there would be some weeks where he just, he can't think straight. And he said to Frank one time, you don't know what it's like to have to depend on other people for your every need.
Ah, totally.
Oh, really?
Thank you.
And he denied he said that when he snapped
but
out of it.
React.
Yeah, he definitely said it.
God.
But he would miraculously, like after the sessions, we would have the others of Frank's students be there, and we'd all kind of get together and play some cards.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, he'd be really lucid.
Yeah.
He'd be completely lucid.
Alive.
He'd win the games, you know. It was just during the sessions, you know. But he did, he actually did end up in the end, you know, really being lusty. And he died getting a blood transfusion and telling jokes to the nurse. He just like kind of...
How old was he?
Not very old.
He wasn't
in his 30s.
But he was in a good place.
Very good place. Yeah. And you could feel he was in a good place because even though we were sad, it felt like he was still with us.
Yeah,
it didn't feel like he was gone.
Yeah. No, that's the difference.
We.
The God on the dirt here.
Have. I. We have ice cream because we celebrate his birthday and death day by having Sundays. Because when he was really sick and he would say, you know, he really feels like just eating ice cream. Frank said, so why not eat ice cream? You're dying. You know?
As much as he wants.
So he started eating. He'd start, you know, getting up in the middle of the night and having milkshakes. Yeah. And
so is that
really
how you celebrate his...
When we found out he died, we made ourselves big sundaes.
Yeah.
And then every year we do that as a
ritual. Oh, nice.
Yeah.
You could cheat and have ice cream other times.
Oh, we do
you
that.
Think about it.
We do that. I'm thinking of Carlos.
Yeah. Thinking of Carlos. That's good.
And I B. L. Oh, right. Frank had us take a photograph of him as the dying man in the body paint and blow it up to life size. And for probably like a year after he died, we still kept him in the performances. And people would go into the tent, and there would be that life-size photograph, and his rap was printed next to it.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. And but Frank added, and I should know because I died. You know.
That's great. So he's alive and kicking somewhere.
Yes. Yeah.
So do you want me to read another poem or something?
Yes.
Let me see if I can find the one I... Because I... well, I thought I'd read... I thought I put these... These are some, you know, newly... Not... I got so many bunches. I didn't have time to... I read one... I should have printed it out. Which I wrote recently about... That I read some from my book. These are also published in other places, but I have it written in another place also. I don't believe this. I'm not. Oh, here it is. Jack would just.
Jack would just.
It's called an Afghan story, and I thought it was. It amused me. He was caught. Making it with a donkey. His defense, I can't afford a wife. I pity the wife to have been, and poor donkey to have been caught up in the economy. I thought that was hysteric. This was a man in Afghanistan who, it's a true story, was actually thrown into prison because he made it with a donkey, and I thought, I can't afford a wife. And the rest, of course, I had to... I thought, well, I don't think I would like to be married to him. Yeah. And this is another little one, just happened to be on the same... In San Francisco, I don't know if you know, on Polk Street, there's a place called Jade Snow Wong. And anyway, she's a travel agent and an artist. I found out I had never met this woman. She's a very old Chinese woman of 90. So anyway, I wrote this poem just simply looking at the sign. I thought it was so beautiful. Jade Snow Wong, Jade Snow Wong. And so then after I just wrote it very quickly. And then after I went in to see her, and she was so beautiful, this woman. Anyway, I know nothing of you except that you were born in snow, far away from Polk Street, where your name still hangs like the last sun, unsurpassable. That's all I knew about her, that she was. And I also, while I'm doing that, I like to read a poem about another woman in North Beach who lives on the streets. And she's the most extraordinary woman. She's called Queen... Well, she's not called Queen Transilla. I call her Queen Transilla. She's called Barbara. And she's remarkable. But I'm telling you in the poems, I should not preempt it. Wrapped in rags on the sidewalk in North Beach, sleeping through the elements, piercing blue eyes in a weather-burned face, with a voice like a resonance from a barrel of finest silk. It's you I bend to listen to, for those sparks released like wild birds, so simply complex, so dazzling in their flight from your palate, whichever way you turn your story, from whatever throne you've climbed, we are on our knees at your twinkle of command, as you advise young girls how to spell Nietzsche, homeless dancer with all the trappings of light and wind, spinning a universe from a paving stone of sheer genius. It's wonderful, this woman. I adore her. You really would. She's always got something very funny to say, and it's just sad that she spends her life on the street. and she's been there for years, but she was an artist, and she can play the flute, and, you know, I don't know what happened exactly.
One of my F favorite artists was Hank. He was a guy that lived on the street, too. And I think in his case, he lived there by choice. He was an older black man. And he used the carts, the shopping carts, but they were like gallery walls. And he would just cruise Berkeley and Oakland all the time. And so when we'd give him flyers for our performances, he'd kind of make a gallery out of them and did a lot of kind of clip art kind
but
of
things. But was it his choice to live on the street?
Yeah, he had family that lived in Berkeley. And he would tell, you know, he would talk about when he would go to visit them because they would want him to come and they'd try to talk him into, you know, living with them or getting a house or something. But he just wasn't interested in that.
Which is the difference between, and more, now it's more difficult to tell the people who actually do want to live outside. You know, it's always been that case. And those who are genuinely very homeless because they can't find that somewhere to live. I think she actually, in one way, wants to live on the street because she sometimes they take her off the street and she goes somewhere and she doesn't like it because it somehow takes away a certain freedom she wants. But I mean, she's an alcoholic, so perhaps that's the reason. But I mean, there are people who actually like to live under the stars. Really, genuinely, and your friend sounds like it.
But yes, but is. Not that why how M O most artists are even if they have homes. Even this isn't that how most artists are. Even when if they have homes.
Do you mean that they? Well, I think some artists, you know, they do want also very regular lives in a sense of place to work and whatever. But one's mind, anyone. Who, I suppose if you call yourself an artist, you want a certain liberation and to do your work. So I think, but I mean, Matisse, for example, just because I just happen to know this, he was very much like a clerk. He wanted a regular life and he even worked almost in a suit. No, whatever. So, yeah, but I think you're right. I think most artists want to be free, but perhaps not live under the stars all the time. Sleep in a bed.
How did you get into the art L I life
Very very early on in my life I knew that I was going to write and the painting was alongside it but there wasn't sort of something you said you couldn't say oh what do you want to be when you grow up? I want to be a writer because that was very pretentious. So but you could say you wanted to be a doctor, you could say you wanted to be a lawyer or whatever, but you could not say you wanted to be an artist or a poet or a writer because for some reason that was very pretentious and, you know, so you didn't. You kept that very much to yourself. But I knew when I was about 12, I'd written this particular story and I just, for some reason, I knew I'd broken through something inside of myself that was a little bit beyond just doing, the, you know, this was at school. I just knew it was good. Mm. And even if my teacher didn't think it was good, I knew it was good. And that's when I knew, I felt it through. And then that, you know, then of course I continued writing, but I also did other things. I mean, I was a teacher and I taught drama and I taught writing and lots of other things for years, and didn't always have enough time to then, of course, do my own work, because I was teaching all the things I wanted to do myself. And I got more and more involved in organizing events and so on and so on. And then I made up my mind and I thought, no, I'll give up that. So I gave all my day jobs up and I devoted myself entirely to my painting and writing. And it was great. It was a great decision, but I was a little bit scared because I had this certain kind of, not very secure, but secure position, if you like. But it didn't make me so happy.
How did you do that? I mean, in terms of like having money to pay your rent and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
A, also in T, terms of the J U jump. How did you do that in terms of the jump, make that jump?
Yeah, that's a good question. to which I know the answer. I just decided that enough was enough. I was very, very tired of what I was doing because I was working so much, organizing events and teaching, and so I would leave the house in the morning at 8, come back at 10. And I no longer enjoyed it in the way I used to. And so I sold my house, which I bought years earlier for very little, and of course, like everywhere else, had gone up. Paid off all my debts, because when I was working, I was still already in debt. I mean, it seemed no difference to me. I was always in debt. I was working, I was tired, and I was always in debt. I couldn't understand it. I got rid of all the debt and bought a much smaller house, and outright. And then I just started doing lots of readings and I did more exhibitions. I sold my work, my artwork sells quite well. And then in Europe, we go on these tours and they don't pay incredible fees, but sometimes good. But they pay for your hotel, they pay for your travel, they pay for all your food. It's a charmed life. That is where the charmed life comes in. So it's a very, very good. So that part of the year, when we are touring and traveling, it's all taken care of by various kind of groups we are performing with. And in between, we live off the you know, whatever else we earn.
Will you be my agent?
Sure, baby. Sure, baby. No, but it's not. It's not a luxurious life. But I'm much better off than when I was working. And really, truly, I mean, working in that sense, you know, being employed by institutions, because I was paying so much in other things. I can't even. Ridiculous. So this is a freer life, with less money, but I need less money, and you know we make enough, and I'll be your agent, Joshua. And we've been lucky, you know, in the sense that the people who have invited us in Europe always invite us back, and it's a knock-on effect, you know. You go to one festival and then you meet people who want to invite you to another festival, who want to, you know. So you're more visible, and that's part of the story. And then, you know, and I used to, actually, I did a little bit of private teaching here as well. which I said I would never teach again, but I have done every now and then. But yeah, to get by, and I'm very good at, you know, I don't go to thrift stores. I'm very good. I find things. I mean, I've always lived like that anyway, so it's not. I never lived in the lap of luxury, so it's no big deal. And I like this much better, though. You know, it's awesome. You have to have a commitment to what you do. You know, it's not just sitting in cafes all day long and thinking, wow, a poem will fall out. You have to work at it. You have to have a discipline, you know, with your writing and your painting. But it's good. I'm not complaining. Though I'm writing a poem at the moment which is going to be on the 1st of May, organized by City Lights, a big reading against the Empire. 30 poems, 3 minutes each. So I'm kind of working on that because I'm trying to find something hopeful in it. But I wanted to tell you what the image I got. So in my dream or waking, I woke up this morning, I had a perfect image I wanted to include in that poem. I dreamt that when they were looking for the weapons of mass destruction all over Iraq and they couldn't find it, and finally they got Saddam Hussein, and then they said, open your mouth, and they looked inside his mouth for the weapons of mass destruction. And it was this image I wanted to use in this poem because I thought it was like the final place where they could find it. You know, do you remember that image on television? Did you see the news?
Yes, yeah. Frank Hussein, yeah.
Yeah. So that was my dream, waking dream, and I want to use it in my poem. They couldn't find it anywhere, so finally they were so desperate they had to look inside Saddam Hussein's mouth.
Oh, that picture, yeah.
To find it, so. I don't know why I got onto that, but that was to do with writing.
Need A B E better F L A S H flashlight
with a better flashlight. Anyway, we'll see if I incorporate this. Is that what you meant?
When they're looking in his mouth,
they
needed a better
flashlight. They didn't find it. There was not even a gun in there. Nothing. So, no, I think I'll incorporate it in my poem, which is, you know, it's going to be this reading with 3 minutes each, 30 poems. It's a long, it's kind of an hour and a half, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I wanted to write something also hopeful, you know. I think that it's so difficult to find the hope, you know, and you really need hope. You can do away with faith, but as long as you find hope, hope is so important. And, you know, there are things to be hopeful about also. I mean, if the world is in such a terrible state of destruction and you think this is the end, but in among all this there are little oases of people working, doing very good positive things, and that is important to remember, I think.
There are more of us than they. There are more of us than them.
Yeah, I think you're right. Although sometimes you think it's not so, but I think you're absolutely right. But, you know, why those few, comparatively speaking, have so much more power, but then we do also have power, actually. So you're right. It's what I'm trying to say, actually, in my poem, in a sense, that
we all, you know, we have power also. We can, we have a voice. We can. Well, I don't literally have one today, but we have a voice.
See, actually, we have much more power, but they don't, but they want, but they don't want us to. REA realize that.
Yeah, absolutely. They don't, because if you actually start looking deeper, they don't want to look at, they don't want us to look at all the grisly things going on. They want it to be kept under wraps, but you know, start digging a little bit. And there's so many inconsistencies. And what really gets me, I think, is that the sheer stupidity of it and the short-sightedness, because it's like, you know, you don't build a house on a rubbish tip, you know, it's going to fall down. But it's this kind of short-term thinking, as long as I make as much money as possible, it's fine, because I'm going to die in so many years, and so never mind the next generation, next generation. And it's that level of thinking that really gets me, the greed, and with greed, stupidity follows very, very short, you know, closely. That what gets me.
I just got an email. From a guy. Not sure which one. Who? Oh, is this the guy from the cafe? Back in like the early 80s, the group of people that we had been, had like a community of people, we did a lot of art and things, had split up, and so for years, Frank and I just would get up every day and walk up to a cafe and sit there and play cards with some of our friends. That was like our life.
Lovely.
Yeah. I mean, but on the one hand, you know, we were aware that we could, because we had like so much before that.
Yeah.
And like it, now we didn't really have anything except this cafe and the coffee and the cards. But we didn't feel that it was like a bad thing.
No.
But we got, Frank got this email from this guy the other day, saying that he was going to school in architect or architecture or something like that. L.A. Landscape architect.
A landscape architect,
And he would see us in the cafe every day. And he was from the suburbs. And he saw Frank and he was loud and boisterous and scary. Loud, boisterous, and scary. And so this is like how many years ago, you know, 20 years ago.
Wow.
And he said, but I have grown to understand you and know you from your art, because Frank had his paintings up at the cafe back at that period.
Right.
And then your website. And he thanked Frank for like being alive and doing, you know, what
he
does.
This was like 20 years late. And
he's still thinking about it. He must have like done a search on Frank or something and found the website. That is the hope, the P, the positive, P-O, the power, and the H-O, and the hope.
Yeah. I think that's, I, not so similar, but a friend of mine also who I hadn't been in touch with for years, and she's quite miserable, and she said, oh, you always end up in a good situation. So, I mean, and I thought, well, and how do you know? How do you do it? And so I said, well, jump off a cliff, like I do. I jumped off many cliffs, and I didn't know what I was going to land in. I just took the risk, and I just said, jump off a cliff. Let's see what happens. You're trying nothing, you know. If you try nothing, if you
nothing happens. I have to do what you love to do.
R. I. Risk.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to risk something, otherwise nothing happens. And I have to admit, sometimes it's very scary because you want, you know, everything you know well, you want to stay with it, even if it's hurtful and painful, rather than trying something new. So you have to be courageous and also speak up.
P-U-T. Put some thing in the P-O. You got to put something in the pot.
Yeah. I like to put something in my pot. But I'm going to read you a poem called, it's not apropos this. I don't know if it's the right one, but let me see. This is not exactly, but it's called Defiance. And it's something I saw in North Beach, where you see a lot of funny things. A man dressed in green is simulating a bullfight with a car. When the cops come, he tucks his flag under his arm and melts into the street. Each one of us watching laughs in oblivion, but we are not oblivious to his fate. There is no need to worry about accuracy when the map on the face is forever changing. And I'll never say no to the gentle power of mad vanity, this naked bearing of defiance glimpsed in these times of crushed hope. Not really to do with it, but... To know something well is to begin again, to open the skin of the universe and step right inside. Lie next to its cheek, kiss its mouth with open eyes. To know something well is like walking on the moon and singing in any language, even if you don't know the words. Whatever passes through can be passed, but what remains is what you know well.
And the N E next S T A stage is not knowing.
And if
the next stage after the stage you described is not knowing.
Well, I'm using it in this sense, because knowing is that, it's that whole thing of, I'm talking really about wisdom, I suppose, in a sense of, and not just innate wisdom, about daring to take risks, speaking any language, even if you don't know the words, which I use there. And the next stage of not knowing, well, you don't know the unknown, you know nothing, you don't try, so the unknown is always your canvas, is what you step into. And that is really the only way to learn, is to step into not knowing. And to actually, even, I don't know if you meant it in this way, but if you did, I would say, to just simply dare to make a fool of yourself and claim your ignorance, display your ignorance, because it's only through displaying your ignorance you can know more. And a lot of people don't do that. They're so proud, so they say, yeah, I know.
I am the F O O, the fool in A.
Tarot. In the tarot pack.
Mikey, tarot I think cards. This isn't it the cover of that one thing? Yeah. That's the easy.
Do you do the tarot cards?
This was an artist in New York that was making. Can you get that, Kirsten? Making a series of the tarot, and what he would do is he'd take photographs of people, and then he doctors the negative and creates that image by doctoring the negative. So Frank
he made
posed,
you into the fool,
and he made Frank into the fool.
I would like to be the fool. How nice. And then does he make it into sort of card size pictures also?
Is that what he does? They're big things.
Oh, so he doesn't actually use it as to read from then?
Not at this point. They're just
but
big.
But what? How lovely. Yeah. That's very lovely. Mm. Oh, so it doesn't, you don't end up in a pack
deck
of tarot cards, Oh, it's nice to be a fool, isn't it? I like to be a fool too. I am a fool also. I don't like to be one. I am one.
She said it's not. She doesn't like to be one. She is one.
Yeah.
The fool, a fool.
Yeah, I was always. So do you want me to read another poem or?
Yes.
Don't know what to read yet. I just see what comes up. I read a love poem now. It's called In the Blue. I see the world when I close my eyes, when I listen in the blue. I hear a voice which has lived in the blue so long that it contains all memories, all mistakes, all fantasies. A voice in zero, where it's quiet, so quiet that I can hear all names in one name, where the blue flame licks this name to a burning whisper. The voice that lifts you from inside, takes you out to sea, where a thunderstorm is building and brings you back over the still water. The voice that goes when nobody else dares, that voice burns in me, in the blue, in the blue. And then, I read, oh, this is a very long poem about a traveling poem to my travels in Guatemala. I read my Yorkshire rap from Yorkshire. This is... It's a silly old poem about Yorkshire. Have you ever, you know, Yorkshire has got a heat. Well, I don't need to explain to you. You know. My voice is unfortunately not strong enough, but. Stone grit, stone grit, stone grit, stone grit, stone grit. Heather wither weather, heather wither weather, heather wither weather, heather wither weather, heather wither weather. Stone grit, stone grit, stone grit, stone grit, stone grit. Rain, 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 rain. Grey, 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 grey. Heather wither weather, heather wither weather, heather wither weather, heather wither weather. Heathcliff, Heathcliff, Heathcliff. More, 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 more. Heather with the weather. Heathcliff. 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 Heather with the weather. Heather with the weather. Heather with the weather. Heather with the weather. Grey, grey, grey. Rain, 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 rain. Stone grit, stone grit, stone grit, stone grit, stone grit. Heather with the weather, 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 heather with the weather. Stone grit, stone grit, stone grit, stone grit, stone grit, stone grit. Stone grit, heather, wither, weather. Heathcliff, grey, rain, more. Have a cuppa. That's what it's like living in Yorkshire.
I.
Even with this voice.
L. I. I lived in Germany. And I can re I can relate to the R to the rain.
To the rain, yeah. Where did you live in Germany?
Bitburg.
Bitburg.
It was near a military force because his dad was in the Air
Force. Oh, your dad was in the force. So. Was it in the northern part? Or, yeah. Whatever. It was in one of those.
N. Yeah. E. Near. L. U. Luxembourg.
Oh, that part, yeah, which is then a bit on the border, yeah, because Luxembourg is part of another country. Sprechen Sie Deutsch?
No. I always say he has a German accent.
Yeah. Oh, you say that?
I say that to Frank, that he has a German accent.
Yeah, that's good, that's good. Yes, you have a very good German accent, I can pick it up too. Just the way you die.
Listen when he talks.
Oh, that's very... Yeah. That's very good. Ach so. So, but you were very... You were just a small child when you lived there.
One.
Yeah. But it rains.
13.
Yeah.
2. 1. 13 through 15.
You remember the rain. Yeah. But in Yorkshire, there's really, because you get these endless moors, and it's very beautiful, but it's sort of very kind of beautiful in its bleakness, you know. And you always have this vision of Heathcliff, you know. And I don't know if you ever read the book or saw the film or of that.
Yes.
I'm going to read you another Yorkshire poem. I think this one. I'm going to read this. It's actually not, this is a sad poem, but I'm going to read it because I have to read sad poems too. It's a poem dedicated to a prostitute who died in Bradford, but really it's dedicated to all prostitutes in the world. And it's called Shivering Mountain, because that's finally where they found her. And it was actually, it was a kind of more familiar name. People in the area used to call it Shivering Mountain. I thought it was just a very appropriate title. He tells her he loves her and beats her heart, every bruise a deepening on her skinny ass, her just formed breasts. You understand, he loves her, and she knows that, as she steps into the dark, damp night, sliding in and out of cars, her tiny body a slot machine. You understand, he loves her, and she knows that, to the sound of a punter's sigh, her childhood laughter disappearing down her throat. They found her in a ditch with sludge in her hair. Her epitaph reads, time of death unknown, place of death unknown. You understand, he loved her. You understand, she believed him. It's a very sad, but it's a poem that I often read in Europe, and people actually, interestingly enough, I've been asked so many times by men, curiously enough, who have translated it. It's translated into Albanian, Estonian. It's very funny. I meet, you know, people at festivals where I read it, so which I think is very good, you know, particularly at the moment, because there's so much white slave trade and poor young girls in the Eastern Bloc, you know, it seems like, you know, they're kidnapped and they're forced into prostitution. So it's, to me, a very important poem. But I can read another one, which is quite different too. The sea, which is, it's so deep, so free, belongs to no one, belongs to you. It licks, moves, washes over without claiming, yet claiming us as equals. Before it, we have no color, no creed. We are as pure as the day we were born, the sound as clear as the water rippling in our mother's womb. So that's quite interesting. Is that mine?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
What is the difference between the REALI reality in Europe and here?
Do you mean life, reality of life? I think that it's a very interesting question to me in many ways, because before I ever came to America, I had a particular view of America, which was very standard view, which many people in Europe have. You know, it's all powerful nation, which it is. And in Europe, and at the moment, because there is actually, with the whole war in Iraq, etc., and the globalization, it's brought it very much closer again. And now, having lived here for a few years, having made lots of friends, having seen that there are many people in America who are thinking just like Europeans vis-a-vis the war. Mm. But if one did not know those people, and one was standing outside of America looking in, you think, oh, they're all crazy. Mm. I mean, how could they vote for anyone like Bush? I mean, you know, because after all, etc. So, because on the whole, if you're looking at news programs, for example, in Europe, on the whole, they're much more objective in the sense that if you take BBC, you know that yourselves. I mean, the BBC is funded by the people. You pay a license fee, so it's mainly essentially the people. So therefore, they can afford being more objective. They're not holding a flag up to the news. You know, they are very critical of the government, and they don't fear of it. They have no fear of it. Until recently, actually, because Blair tried something he didn't want to hush up, and it was a big scandal. So one has a sense, and I think so, that Americans, and now I'm generalizing because that's what I'm saying, it's a very, very easy to generalize, and I'm finding it harder and harder to generalize because I now know all the Americans who have, in my opinion, very good views and are very realistic about the world situation. But when you're on the other side of the puddle and just see it as one big country, you think they're crazy. And your mom says, they're crazy, like you say, like Vera Fern, I actually don't like this very much. They, as a whole country, is one opinion, you know. Like all the Iraqis are just one. I mean, there are, this is a very problem that they're facing in Iraq, is that they assume that they would all, they all hated Saddam Hussein, and it would all be very easy, and suddenly they have found that they're all coming from different factions, and they've actually broken them all up. So now they've really got a civil war in their hands. And that is one's own ignorance of thinking that you can solve everything and that everyone is the same. You can't. People are not. To me, most people in the world, in every country I've ever been, I think you'll find people exactly kind of very similar to yourself, the kind of people think along the same lines, and they will get on. And wherever you are, and you know, even if you have different cultural beliefs or whatever, there is something that unites you. And the more one travels and the more one is open to this, actually, the less wars there would be. Because you're not working on differences, you're working on actually what unites us all.
W. H. I. Rich. Is. How. Why. They. M. A. Make. It. Hard. To. T. Travel. Which is why they make it hard to travel. So people aren't in a position to have that experience that you just described.
What do you mean make it hard to travel? Exactly. I mean, do you mean...
Well, there's like different, like just like the whole, in the best of times, the whole thing of nationalism, so you have to get all these tests and passports.
Oh, you're
and
talking
everything.
About all the bureaucracy of actually, yes. you know, having the visa, et cetera.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense that in it's very hard to get into America. I mean, and I've been there, you know. Myself having to, I mean, I lied actually once, and I sort of, because I came here and then I overstayed my welcome and I went back for 5 weeks. And they said, oh, you're back very soon, sort of thing. And I said, well, I'm actually writing a book about San Francisco and I haven't quite completed it, and that seemed to do the trick. I mean, they would let me in too because I'm white. It's easy for me, I'm white, you know. But it's still tough at the borders, and on the whole, I mean, of course, if you're traveling Europe now, it's very easy because it's, you know, the European Union, it's never been easier. But nevertheless, when you get to borders, they're much more, they scrutinize people much, much more, except if you're, let's say, within Europe, but if you're an American, let's say, they're coming to Europe now, they're going to scrutinize you too, or if you're an Arab, God forbid, you're really, well, you will hardly be let in. You're immediately assumed to be a terrorist or a potential one. So, but otherwise, you know, before the 9/11, I didn't find it so very hard to travel. I found it kind of quite easy. I remember going to Central America, going from Guatemala into Honduras, because I needed to renew my, you know, you get 3 months, and I want to stay a bit longer. So I just hopped across the border and came back, and that was easy, you know. You paid a little bit of money or whatever. And I found it, curiously enough, surprisingly easy. And I loved also that discovery of, you know, when you arrive in a country, you're a little bit scared. I was a woman of my own in Guatemala City, and I thought, oh my goodness, this is scary. The minute I got on a bus and sitting like this, you know, with hens and chickens and people, I felt elated and safe, totally safe. I was more scared in Miami than I was on this bus in Guatemala, let's say.
Four. G, good, for good reason, more scared in Miami than in the bus.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, you know, at that point, people warned you about, especially if you're a woman traveling on your own, don't go to, if you go to Guatemala, you really have to watch out because there are a lot of political unrest and, you know, don't go out late at night. But I never really felt, except once perhaps, but I mean, that's normal, that, tiny bit threatened, but I, on the whole, I felt very okay. But I mean, I did observe certain codes, which I think you do if you go to another culture, another country. You don't. I don't believe you can't always insist on being yourself.
I mean, that's kind of being a little bit arrogant. You just say, okay, this is a law in this country, so within reason you have to adapt yourself to that. You don't throw your clothes off in a country which is, you know, deeply religious. You just don't. I think that's unwise.
Yes. I have a STU, a student in Canada who comes here like once a year and to work with Frank.
Yeah.
She'll do an intensive, like a couple, a week or two intensive. At first, she, T-U-T-Y-T-H, thought A, Americans, didn't have a good opinion of Americans, is that right? Yeah, this was back, though, before us, even, because she went to school.
She hadn't met you there. No, but I didn't either. I didn't have... the curious thing for me, as a, because I was born in Sweden. I was there for the first 24 years of my life. And I said, always said, I'm never going to go to England and never to America, never. Two countries I end up living in. So, never is never. So that's why I said, I was very kind. My brother said, oh, you like it in England? No, I'm not going to England. I don't want it. It's just too stuffy, you know, I don't want to go there. I'd rather go to France or whatever. And I was just never going to go to America. That was it. It's just, I was so sure. And you know, I have to remind myself that I went against myself. So I'm not trustworthy, you know. Can't trust myself for 1 second. And I like, and in fact, well, San Francisco is very special. My America is an amazingly beautiful country. My two husbands were American. I mean, that's the other irony.
But they are poets.
Different, they're special people.
That is not Americans.
That's true. They are not poets and artists are no nationality. You're right. They are completely in another land altogether. And does one like English people? Does one like French? I loathe some of all, but. And I don't really like what America stands for at all. I really don't. I find that in America that women are very, very, and I'm generalizing, of course, because they are not my friends are not like this, my American friends. It's actually that the society is obsessed by looks. And it's just so tedious and boring. You know, I think, you know, nips and tucks and lifts and obesity and thinness and this and just, you know, everything within reason. And I find that people are very nervous about and neurotic about the way they look.
You don't find that in Europe?
No, not to that extent at all. But it's getting that. That's what really worries me. No. On the whole, and I'm of course again generalizing, but on the whole, women are not as, they're much more natural, they feel more natural in their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And but they're going that way too.
Mm.
I mean, it's a book actually coming out in America. I can't remember the name now, but it's written by an American, and it's about obsession, about obesity and fatness and all this. And he says the whole thing is just, you know, it's a big hype to sell a lot of things because it is not. For example, you look at black women are not so obsessed about being anorexically thin. I mean, they like shapes. And now, you know, they're even trying to get them to go into this kind of anorexic state. And it's not healthy. It's, you know, we're meant to be the way we are, a little bit more, a little bit less so. We don't have to all look like little Barbie dolls, you know. Mm. So I don't like that, and I think that
it gives me something to work on with your students. Is that what you mean? With your students, or no, with just the culture? It gives you something to work on in this with this culture to get people over that.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's really important because I think it's also other things follow from that, you know, that, I mean, everything we do, I'm not only talking about the way we look, but which is done with moderation, is actually good for us. And if you become too obsessive, it destroys that internal life. You know, you become very insecure. And people are very insecure about the way they are. They have to go on all these kind of self-development courses, which I've, by the way, taught, and I didn't believe in it in the end anyway. Because I don't believe there is only one way, I think, and that is to do what you love doing most. Simply that, and of course we don't always get, and all people, of course, don't get to do what they love most.
But the K, but the L, I, the lie, is you can not do what you want to do. H, J, you just N, O, just now. You can't do what you want to do just now.
No.
You, you need something else before you're able to do it.
Yeah.
Like you need to have a degree, or you need to have a certain amount
of
money.
Yeah, you need to educate. I deeply believe in education, but at the same time, I don't believe in vocational education. I think that's the biggest horrible thing that happened to education, is that no longer can students enjoy education for the fun of it in order to learn. There's always going to be, oh, this is a good business to go into, or this is a good business. I was very fortunate, grew up in the period when actually you could go and enjoy what you wanted to enjoy, and it didn't matter. You didn't have to have all A's. Everyone is nice, I've got to have A's. And it's got to be, you know, you've got to know when you're five what you're going to do when you when you grow up. I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up. And when I actually grew up, you did not have to know what you wanted to do because there was enough choice. And one wasn't as streamlined. Of course you did, you know, you did pick if you wanted to study languages or math or whatever. But there wasn't that desperation, and this is all over the world. It's not just in America. It's the same in England. Children have lost, you know, the love of learning because they have to decide so very early what they're going to be, and then
or you need tea. A. L. Talent. You're told you need talent before you can't write if you don't have talent.
I think that almost without exaggeration, and having been in teaching many years myself, that everyone can learn to do something, and quite well. I mean, not everyone is a genius, but we don't have to be geniuses. I mean, that is actually a word that I think is used too often anyway. I mean, and a genius doesn't actually have to be somebody who's necessarily very wise. A genius can be somebody, well, the person who invented the light bulb, we could say Edison was a genius, but he might have been very bad at doing something else. I mean, whatever a genius is, I mean, I think it's somebody who's a good composer, for example, I will always say, oh, it's a genius. But it's this whole thing about comparing people, setting one off against the other, and the competition, instead of actually getting to the best part inside of yourself.
F. R. A. Fragment. That's Frank's always talking about fragmentation. That's out there to try and fragment everybody and every aspect of your life.
You know, and I think people feel very fragmented because of, you know, because there seems to, this is so ironic also, I think, that, you know, with all this fantastic technology, instead of steadying us and giving us more time, is making people much more nervous and neurotic, and much more is, you know, people have to be seen to be doing. And when you're working in an institution, you have to be seen to be doing at all times. Even what you're producing is rubbish. As long as you're seen to be doing, you can perpetuate this myth that you're actually working. And if you go into an office or institutions, many times you see people sitting at computers. They're not working, they're just playing. Because they have to be at work from, you know, 9 to 5, and if you have to be seen to be doing. I've been there myself, so I know exactly it's a mess.
I was. Always. L. Lucky. Because Frank wasn't involved in any of that aspect of life.
You escaped it.
Yes.
Well, believe me, it's not a pretty picture, but in among that, of course, there are good things happening too, but it's what I don't like about what's happening more and more. And I never kind of understand that even people who are supposedly very well informed actually perpetuate this when it can only go to hell. And it does. It stresses. People are enormously stressed, and children are stressed. You shouldn't be stressed when you're a child.
Yes.
They're getting too fat, or they get too thin, or they have to do all that.
Is there even S U such a thing as T A. L. Talent.
Or aptitude, I think. I think that. But it's a, that's a good question. Actually, it's a really good question. I have to. Is that anything
else?
Talent.
Because. Do. M. A. Many things. Oh, like you paint, or you write poems, you direct, all those things. Yeah. C. But. P. E. People. Think. T. A. Talent is one. People think talent is in one O P A part, R, particular field. So you think that people limit, they'll think that somebody is a talented painter or a talented this, rather than that somebody could do all
many
of those
things.
Where?
Well, that's because I do many things too, and I don't see the problem at all, because one thing links in with something else, and, you know, like writing and painting and directing, or it all belongs together. I don't see that as a problem at all.
One thing. It's all one thing.
I think it's all one thing. It's a creativity. And, you know, you learn certain aspects. I mean, that's the beauty of learning something you've never done before, and suddenly you say, oh, I can do this. And then you learn more about it. And it's a discovery. I would say that some people are more mathematical than others. That's for sure, because I know that people can struggle a lot with math, for example. But perhaps even that, you know, if it was taught in a good way, because I can remember having teachers who were not particularly good, and then you got another teacher and suddenly it was all clear. Or you learned it yourself later in life. Suddenly they that's what they meant. 40 years later, they... God, that was easy. But, you know, 40 years earlier was hard. Yeah, I think that I'm with you. Talent is so strange, it's debatable. And you're not... It all comes together in one great big pot for me. Art.
But? T-A. Talent. And C, creativity. R is U S E used to B U I build A E L E elite. The ideas of talent and creativity are used to build elite. Build an elite.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, it's. But again, that to me, you know, it depends on from where you're looking, from which standpoint you come from. I can remember when I was younger and I thought, you know, going to an art gallery for an opening, you know, the clique of the art world, it was very pretentious and, you know, and I'm doing an English video. Oh, darling, oh, terrible, nice, yeah, golly, oh, marvelous, pain, marvelous, marvelous. Oh, my God, you see the perspective, you know, and I thought, that, and it, you know, it was a very elitist kind of crowd. And then the older I got, and I felt that they were actually rather silly little buggers, and that the real artists were operating on a completely different level, and there was no elitism. I think, however, that the elitism comes in is because, again, you know, we are being judged, and, you know, you have an exhibition there, an exhibition there, and you get all your critique, and, you know, I can't fall into it myself. I'm not at all impressed by the way. But you have to have your CV, you know, your resume, you call it here. And you have to... Oh, yes, my latest exhibition, which I actually was really pleased with. And someone said, oh, it's great. But, you know, you should... some of your paintings look like they're from different periods. I said, that's right. That's what I want, different styles. What? That's the way I paint. I said, I don't want to just have one style. Yeah, but the critics like it if it's just, so I don't care about the critics. It's my paintings. You know, I get very bored with one style. I go to another. And, you know, I have five styles, let's say, but they're all related. And to me, that's just so ridiculous to say, because that is
fitting right into the streamlined expectations of the art world, the critics. And who are the critics? Mm. They're usually failed artists or whatever. Mm. And that perhaps is a bit nasty to say, but...
I find A L almost every P E R person does A C R E A T creation,
yeah.
Creativity. Almost every person does a
creative.
I V creative. Almost you find that almost every person is creative.
Yeah, but they are in one way or another. Whatever they do, you know, gardening is creative. Cooking is creative. Some people just are so fearful of, you know, if I can't paint, so I won't do it. And then suddenly if they do it, if I, well, actually I can paint. Of course everyone can paint. You know, it's, you're right. Everyone is creative. You know, but more, some people just don't know about their creativity.
But... if everyone can create,
I think I know what he's going to
do. Where is the S, the specialness of being creative?
That's what a lot of people... Well, you see, that's where competition comes in again.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter at all. I mean, if you do what you love to do, and that's good enough. I mean, that the whole block does the same thing. Doesn't matter. It doesn't actually, in any sense, minimize your work. It doesn't. And then somebody will of course say, oh, that's, yours is much nicer. Your apple looks more like an apple or whatever. You know, it's like a child, for example, when they paint, they're like that size, and they look up at a person. So they always paint a person, most children with very long legs. And the teacher said, but that's not what the person looks like. Of course, they're not going to be... Actually, it's very short-sighted of the teachers to say that. So, oh, I don't look like that if they paint the teacher. So.
In C. C. O. L. College. A. As. A. As a joke. I. Took. A. A painting class. Yeah. Frank took a painting class as a joke.
Yeah, as a joke.
To see what would happen, what the teacher would do. He would not critique Frank's work because I did. Because I painted with my head, not hands.
He wouldn't. Extraordinary. He wouldn't.
That's right.
Oh, what? Well, I. It's a strange teacher. Very short-sighted. Perhaps he was very short-sighted. That was the problem. Not short-sighted, short-sighted. Yes. Yeah, that's a sad. The teacher, I mean, there are some terrible teachers in the world who have destroyed, you know, people for life because they were, you know, say, you can't sing or you can't do that. Or parents for that matter too. This is not your area. This, you can't do it. So and so can do better. So you do what you can. I don't accept. I think everyone can.
I. Mikey. Am I. No, M. O. Most of my W O work W I with S T U students is undoing what they were taught and told.
Yes. That's actually very difficult to undo what people have been taught wrongly or in oneself also. But it's a very important task. I used to do that at school also when I was teaching. I love doing that. I just loved, especially with students who have very little confidence to, you know, to go in there and find what really worked for them. That was the most interesting thing for me in teaching. To discover
why do teachers no, why do teachers tell S students they can not.
Well, it's because they're like all other human beings. I don't know why they're not. This is, of course, doesn't go for all teachers, because it's easier that way. I think it's like if you have a class. I can remember from when Mom was little, anywhere where I was brought up, and you would read aloud. And the teacher would always ask the same people all the time to read. And there would be always students that are dying to read, but they were never encouraged. And it was easier that way because it gave the teacher an easier time, you know. Let's have the ones that are not going to struggle or stammer or whatever. And I think it's partly a form of laziness, actually, or lack of imagination. And I mean, we have all been guilty of sometimes going to the easiest point because we are lazy, we're making a shortcut. And that, in that way, we could actually deny somebody over-expressing themselves. I've done it with my son. Instead of him carrying something through because I was in a hurry, I said, oh, I'll do it then. But actually, I took away some of, you know, it's the power of discovery. So I'm sure I'm guilty of it too. I try not to be, but it's laziness, lack of imagination, I think.
And it is S. T R U structured for of what is A C A C C E A-C-C-E, acceptable. It is, you said it is structured for what is acceptable. That's the way, like, the school system and society is set up. But, yeah.
But I don't quite know exactly what you mean by the structure for what is acceptable. What do you mean? You mean,
like, O Like P, E, people.
Yeah.
Think there is a, like a right way and a wrong way to do something.
Oh, yeah, 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 I see what you say. Yeah.
Yeah. To P, L, play the piano, for example.
Yeah. But then, of course, you know, this, I remember that just really frustrated me. This is the only way you can do something, it's no other way. And of course, and the same in math, especially because math is something that lots of people were turned off because the teacher would only teach in one particular way. And I remember a math teacher showed one another way and suddenly, oh my goodness, it was so much easier. And there was another way. And there's always another way. There's always, you know, to think laterally, not always in a linear way.
Like, I started playing the piano.
Yeah.
Is that it? Yeah, Frank plays the piano now when we have musicians here and also a gig sometime. And he doesn't play it the normal way.
You played?
He plays it
your way.
His way.
Yeah. It's perfectly acceptable. Whatever way. I mean, I had an accordion, and before I could even, I used to just sit like this, and I thought it was so beautiful. And of course, it wasn't beautiful to other people, but I thought this is magic, and it sounded like I was in a church, and I was like Bach and whatever. But I didn't make one single familiar, you know, tone. It was my own composition. Completely arbitrary, but I thought it was beautiful, and it is. And actually, you know, one can arrive at, you arrive at your own compositions if you, I don't exactly know which way you're playing, but I imagine you do.
Yes. Yeah, well, what happened is he, you know, he started out like he'd have a musician come in and say, can I jam with you?
Yeah.
You know, and the musician would like it. You know, they would say, I like jamming with you. I love the way you play the piano. So then it gave Frank more confidence to keep doing it.
So you came up with a new way of playing the piano. Yes.
He uses, you know, it's more like a percussion instrument.
Yeah, so you use, how his do
whole
you use
arms
it?
And his whole body. He's like, you know, you we bandage him up and he's like playing like with his arms. Yeah.
Great. But it's, there is no right or
wrong
way.
It's beautiful. It's
yeah,
beautiful.
I know, I imagine it is, because you're right, there is no right or wrong way. There's always a way. And that's, I suppose that's how the world was pushed forward, because somebody found another way.
But
to
most people think they can not play the piano, play the piano, because they don't know how to play it the acceptable way.
Yeah, so that's, the piano's out. This is right, but that also goes with a lot of, and that's very, a lot of people have that thing with instruments, you know, they don't dare to try it.
Most L I F life is O U out. Most of life is out for that same kind of thinking.
Yeah, it's. I think you're completely correct. It really stops you from having so much fun. You know, really. And then you're sort of sitting in your little box afraid of trying something new. I'm going to, I mean, I play a little bit of piano, but I don't care. I sit by myself and what I don't know, I just invent. That's brave of you. I love to hear it. Have you got recordings of it?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff on our...
You have a site
on our
I can look up on your website, can't I?
Do we have any of the jams that Frank plays piano on the website?
Can I look up on your website?
Yes, we'll give you the info
before
give
me
you leave.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because I love to listen to it.
Yes.
I'll give you...
I give you my expert opinion. So.
It's almost 10. What should you, would you read a few more poems?
Yeah.
And one of my poems?
Yeah, I would like to read one of your poems very much. Yeah.
Do you have one in mind?
Have you got it?
Yes. Can't remember what it's called. The most recent one? No, the one I W wrote for A C L A class of doctors. No cannots, I think it's called. Yeah.
All right.
Okay,
so
I'll look for it.
I'll read you this one, meanwhile. Summer near the ice. Wingbeat of fate puts you there between the ribs. She in a multi-layered coat, stepping out of white snow, tall and proud, bending over the cot, bending over backwards to please. Who she was she, grey hair at the beginning, a faint smell of perfumed powder somewhere near the eyes. Whoever said you had to be happy, as if happy was a birthright. The lioness with a cub thought everything in her path a gift from God. To think we all came out from roughly the same hole, striving for the light eyes squeezed. To think how nice it would be to sometimes crawl back in again and curl up in our mother's womb nest, uncut, unbroken, to begin again at the beginning, squeaky clean. Honey, they say honey a lot here, and sugar too. What to do with all that sugar, I don't know. The sweetest thing I ever saw, tasted of citrus through and through, sharp and sweet at the same time. And there she is again, in the midst of bombs falling, bending forward, reaching down to lift a terrified child to her calm. Sort of about, I used a bit on my mother's about, you know, the whole kind of concept of mother and the protector or whatever. So, yeah, I love to read yours.
It's right there.
It's called No Cannots. I like to say no cannots, no cannots, no cannots. I can say war like too. No cannots. Talking to future healers and teachers and maybe future muckrakers and troublemakers, well, not really future, because hopefully you are doing it right now. Hopefully, I'm not talking to the future gods of the corporate normalcy, armed with cannots, limiting futures from birth, enforcing coloring only within the lines, enforcing doing everything the right way, the normal way. That's great. I like that very much. Oh, it's almost... Oh, there was almost exactly 2 years ago.
Wow.
Sunday, April 28, 2002.
Wow.
And shall I finish with the... Well, we are gone over time anyway, aren't we? So. Oh!
You should, yeah, you could read another one. Isn't that right? Yeah.
Well, I thought I'd read you my 9/11 because it's a poem that I just brought my multicolored stained copies because that 9/11. Out of nowhere, two silver birds. The twins collapse, now ground zero, a big hole, nothing. After, he says, you're either with us or against us. He was a good man, she was a good woman. She wanted the best for everyone, he wanted the best. He loved his children, he phoned me twice a day. She phoned me four times a day. He was such a good son, she was a good daughter. He lived for his family, she lived in the office. He always cooked me breakfast, she had such a bright future. He was only 25. He never said a bad word about anyone, she never spoke much. She'd only been in this country for 5 years. He was a good American, she was a good Christian, he was a good Muslim, he was a good Jew. She was a good Catholic. She had just had a baby. He had just got married. She lived with her parents. He was always the first one in the office. She was always the last one to leave. He was the world's best son, friend and father. She was the world's best mother, daughter and friend. She was the only daughter I had. He was the only son I had. She was good, he was good, she was good, he was good, she was good, he was good, she was good, he was good. Ahmed had just left his house when a bomb falls with pinpoint error and wipes out his entire family. As this dying witness, land is my witness. I didn't do anything. His arms flailing, his heart full of holes. Tomorrow, nobody will smile. Saji sold his daughter for a sack of flour to someone who came by, lusting after her green eyes. Now they eat in silence while metal birds overhead open their beaks wide and vomit their shiny piercing sputum again and again, making all of Afghan land ground zero. Here, there is no compensation when you die, not even an audible I'm sorry. And here, I enter this poem myself, because I want to reach into the world's blind eye, tear off the veil that separates us from them, and put a name to every man, woman and child, who against all odds keep on building and living on dirt and hope.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I should have ended on more.
I think I... You could let it. That's okay. I think I have... H-E-A heard... You read that on a SH a show?
Yeah, on the radio. Yeah, I think you did, perhaps, if you listened to the. I read it a few times on radio station.
We P. L. A. We played it on Lover.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't remember where and how.
Good memory.
Yeah, you recognize
good
it.
Good memory.
Yeah. Yeah. And was it D E M O C Democracy Now?
It could, I think it could have been, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that there was recorded and they played it on something, it was several stations, mm-hmm. so. Oh, it's hot.
Yeah. So, would you read I See I Came to Play one more of Frank's poems?
Yeah, I would yeah. love to.
That's in the book I'm going to use.
I would love to.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe we open the front door. Yeah, we'll open the front door. It's that poem.
Okay. Okay.
So,
I came to play. I came to play. Came to the table to play. Mm-hmm. I don't care what I have to do to get a seat at the table. I play every hand dealt to me. Not really caring about winning or losing or about skill, just playing hands to stay mm-hmm. in the game. Yes, I'm a dangerous mm-hmm. player. Keep mm-hmm. on playing. I came to play. Came to bed, not to fuck you, but to melt with you, enjoying mutual mm-hmm. surrender, washing pleasure swept away into oneness, exploring skin from the inside, beyond time, beyond self, into the fun of being, into exploring the furry, cozy, sweating love that can't be confined to the bed, but claims the whole life as its playpen. What a lovely poem. And it goes on. Mm-hmm. I came to play, to mix things up, to see what unexpected will appear, to jam with playmates, to lose ourselves within one another, within the playing, the dancing, the touching, the music, into listening and melting. I came to play, playing life the best way I can, always playing against the house, against the odds. Not a smart player, never in competition. Just keep my eye on the ball, on each hand, on following the every move of Lady Luck. I came to play often in the lonely fields beyond taboo, breaking through the wall to new possibilities. But I am a team player, always looking for playmates to get muddy or sweaty with, to get muddy or sweaty with, because truth be told, playing with myself, for myself, has never been fun, only lonely. I came to play with colors, noises, realities, bodies, words, characters, limits, dreams, images, life, death, symbols, magic, and with you. I came to play, and I'm a dangerous player, because I don't play for money, fame, power, or from anger, bitterness, hatred, emptiness, or to win. So I can't lose, can't be beaten. I came to play just for fun. Just to change everything. I came to play after all. I want to play with you. We are mammals after all. Oh, lovely. I love that. It's like a wonderful poem. I came to play. I came to play. And I had fun. Oof.
So is that a wrap? Okay. So
I love that. Thank you so much. It's best things the box you can use my sound.
I T H O I thought the W E A weather C changed CH channel M made a typo. We had the Weather Channel on last night that said it was going to be in the 80s in this area, and Frank thought they made a typo. There was no way that it was going to be in the 80s today.
It's been in the 90s.
Has it been today?
In the 90s in San Francisco, it was so hot.
Yeah.
I thought it was a typo, really.
He's like, look, they made a mistake. They said it's going to be in the 80s. Oh.
Well, they were right. They were wrong because I think it's hotter than, I don't know what it was like here, but
it was hot.
Yeah.
That is R A R rare. It's rare that it's hotter than what. What? That you're wrong.
Oh,
it's rare that you're wrong.
They're right. Well, I'm very pleased to meet someone who's never wrong. Yeah, great.
Okay, so is that a wrap? Agneta Falk. And your books are probably, they could just get them at
City Lights.
City Lights, Cody's. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
And Lefka, there's going to be on Thursday at City Lights. This coming Thursday.
This coming Thursday.
7 o'clock.
That would be April 29th.
Publication reading party at City Lights. 7 o'clock.
Okay. Player's going to stop, hit play again.
And that's for you, too.
Thank you.
And that's for me. Great.